The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Welcome to IMC, for those of you who are new. Thank Carl for your nice words. And it just happens that the topic for today is compassion. I was kind of asked to talk about the topic, and I thought it would be a nice topic for the end of the year or the beginning of the new year. And in thinking about compassion, I thought about how much it's needed in this world of ours. And many people say so, and all religions emphasize it. And now, you know, it's still reverberating in my heart that I spent a little bit of time yesterday with a woman, an elderly woman with brain tumor and hardly much memory at all, but with a lot of anxiety. She understood her state she was in and a lot of anxiety, and then spending time with her husband, who seemed elderly but seemed quite clear and bright and somehow concerned about it. But then I came home, my wife said, "Oh, by the way, he has Alzheimer's." And very touching to my heart. And it's easy to kind of come across lots of stories like that. Probably some of you over the holidays have been in touch with people who are in some state of suffering or something. Maybe some of you are as well. And so there's a world, we live in a world that compassion is needed, because compassion is a movement of caring for others and for ourselves, to encounter suffering and problems in the world and be concerned about it and care about it. And it's really one of the most beautiful qualities of the heart, is to be compassionate and caring. It's a kind of strange beauty, because it's a beauty that is so seemingly, on the surface at least, so closely tied to suffering. And so there has to be a willingness to be present for suffering or to see it for compassion to usually appear. And so they kind of go hand in hand. It's like two sides of the same hand, perhaps. That you can't, you know, you talk about compassion, how beautiful it is, but not far away, we're also talking about suffering. I think of compassion as there being two kinds of compassion. And these are kind of, I don't know if you don't like these categories, but maybe you can categorize it different ways if you'd like. But I like to think of compassion of the mind and compassion of the heart. And the compassion of the mind is the public teaching that's very common in Buddhism. And the compassion of the heart is the public secret of Buddhism. It's public, open secret, because it's public because, you know, it's important. But it's a secret because you can't really talk about it. You have to experience it. It's something that's inner. And part of what we're trying to, what happens in Buddhist practice, I believe, is discovering this beautiful secret that's in each of our hearts and having this kind of ripen and flower within us. In my situation, when I was first encountered Buddhism in my young 20s, I had no interest in compassion. And I think the books that I read about Buddhism back then, as far as I can remember, didn't really have the word compassion or discussion about it very much. Maybe some of you remember those books, some of you way back then. But like I read the books of Alan Watts. How much compassion is there in Alan Watts? Maybe he was, but I can't remember. It doesn't come to mind. It's beautiful books on Zen and stuff, and that doesn't stand out to me. Or D.T. Suzuki, his books on Zen, and Suzuki Roshi, I think his Zen My Beginner's Mind. I don't think there's much emphasis or talk about compassion. But I never knew Suzuki Roshi, but I know that many people who did. And he might not have talked much about compassion, but he was a very compassionate person. And I think that's part of the reason people were attracted to him. And maybe he didn't have to talk about it, because maybe he was compassionate. David, you knew him, right? Was he compassionate?
Yes, sir.
And did he talk much about it?
No, but his presence was
full. Made up for it, right?
It was tangible.
Yeah, so the public secret.
Yes.
And And so, when I came into Zen, I wasn't thinking about it much or concerned or even interested in it. And if anything, I would say I was interested in enlightenment. And over those first years of practice, I don't think I got any enlightenment, but I got compassionment. And to my surprise, as I did my practice, I found that my heart opened up. It was kind of, the way I described it to myself was that the crusts of my heart fell away. Or practice was the tenderizer. That you put tenderizer on the meat and it gets soft. So practice was a tenderizer on my heart and it softened it up. And it wasn't expected. It just seemed to happen slowly. And it happened a lot because in the Zen practice I was doing then, the emphasis that I had was just stay present. And I wasn't given a lot of tools or techniques or things to do except just stay present. And stay present for what? Well, I spent hours sitting there in meditation on retreat in the Zendo, just being present, tenderizing, letting go. And one of the things that I encountered was my own suffering. And I didn't really have much to do about it. I wasn't given a lot of instructions on how to be with my suffering except be with your suffering. Just be there, be present. And that kind of very simple presence, keeping it really simple, without getting into a lot of ideas and thoughts about it or be aversive to it or try to fix it, but just be present is a very, very powerful thing to do. And now, many years later, I teach people skills in Buddhist chaplaincy. People who are going to go into hospitals to be chaplains, and usually are chaplains in hospitals for people, or hospice, of people who, in conventional terms, are in crisis. Their life is sometimes in tremendous disarray or tremendously challenged with some of the greatest suffering people can encounter. And probably the most useful skill that we teach chaplains is be present. Just to be there, be present, and have the capacity to be present without trying to fix it. And many chaplains have to be taught, it's a very hard skill to learn, the skill of not fixing. Because fixing somehow conveys the wrong message. And there's something very powerful. Isn't wrong fixing? If you can fix something, fix it, please. If a person's dying, fix it, please. But there's something very different that gets conveyed to a person if you can be present. It allows something to soften and unravel and open up that can't open up if you're there to tinker and technique and make something, you be in charge and make something happen. So many times, just being present, people open up in a way that's very hard to open up in other ways, in other circumstances. So a big part of what Buddhist practice is about learning how to be present in a very simple way. So this is what happened to me as I learned to be present and present. And at first, I noticed this in retrospect, but at first I started tuning in to what was compassionate around me. And I would see compassion in other people. Or I found a beautiful photograph of the Japanese bodhisattva, kind of archetype of compassion called Kuan Yin or Avalokiteshvara. And I was not iconically interested, in Buddhism. But that icon, that kind of picture of Kuan Yin, just seemed so compassionate. It seemed to resonate and speak to me in a way. And in many ways, I saw compassion around me. And sometimes I would just feel it in the breeze as the wind kind of blew against my cheek. It just felt the breeze was compassionate. And I think what was happening was compassion was being born in me. But I didn't recognize it as such within myself. I could only recognize it outside. And at some point, I recognized that something was being born inside of me or becoming a blooming or blossoming inside of me. So I said there's two kinds of compassion, the compassion of the mind, the compassion of the heart. And please don't take these categories or these descriptions as being too hard and fast. It's just what works for me. But the compassion of the mind is the compassion here, for me, is the compassion of ideas, the compassion of, you know, perhaps of obligation. You should be compassionate, please. And okay, now you hear that, and they say, okay, I got to go out there and find someone and try to generate my thoughts of goodwill and caring and figure out what to do. And, you know, Gil says be present, so okay, what does that mean? And, you know, and try to negotiate the world of ideas and shoulds and shoulds, shouldn'ts and techniques and understanding and how do I understand people so I have compassionate. There's nothing wrong with that approach, and there's actually a lot of wisdom to it, to think wisely and considerately and understand the situation through our mind as best we can. The other way is of the heart, and the heart is not mediated through concepts and words. It's not mediated through the idea of there's someone out there and there's me here. There's someone out there who's suffering and there's me here who's going to help that person who's suffering or engage with the person who's suffering. The heart is that sensitivity that we have that that simply is sensitive, that's receptive to the world around us, and then receptivity, it gets activated, or we feel empathy or care. So, you know, if you go out and and dress up really warmly, like I did today, and then I was surprised to leave the house and find out it was actually pretty warm here today. The sun was out. And so the sensitivity I could feel of the warmth in my body, and there just came kind of a natural desire to take off a sweater or something. I didn't have to think about it, but it just so that, you know, I felt I could feel the warmth in my body. So the same thing with compassion, you feel this warmth in the heart, or this resonance in the heart, when it's open and present for the world around us. But it's more than that. What I found, and I think what Buddhism has often pointed to down through the centuries, is that when the heart becomes empty or open or sensitive, it doesn't need an object to feel compassionate, but it's somehow inherent in the heart, the open, empty, relaxed heart, to have compassion, going to be a field of compassion. That doesn't really make sense to talk about an object, a person and me and the other person. It's just a field of caring, a field of kindness, a field of empathy, a field of compassion. That has a feel that feels very, I don't know if delicious is the right word, but feels like you're at home. Feeling of being at home or being relaxed or safe or comfortable. And so one of the primary conditions that support the compassion of the heart is to be relaxed, is to relax. And one of the reasons why this kind of compassion becomes stronger as people meditate or practice is they tend to become more relaxed. Or some of the tension or preoccupations that we have that keep us kind of tense, caught, begin to relax and to settle away. And in that settling away, then what's in the functioning of the heart can function better, more fully. So if you're in the opposite of compassion, in Buddhism, we usually say the opposite of compassion is hatred or cruelty. But there's other things that prevent compassion, heart's compassion from operating as well. So greed or lust, fear, make it very hard to feel compassion. And one of the reasons for that is that to have greed or hate or fear or a lot of delusion and confusion means that you're kind of, a person's caught up in thoughts and ideas. When I was asked yesterday to kind of counsel this woman who was, to help her out, she was a little bit with, who had this brain tumor, and there was a lot of anxiety. It was at a Christmas party. So it wasn't the usual kind of place to sit down and have a conversation. And so I thought, well, and this person seems like he can't track things much anymore, so I better say something really simple to her that maybe she can remember, or the people around her can remember, her caretaker. And so I said to her, probably the best thing you can do to help you with your anxiety is don't believe your thoughts. And I kind of suspected that no one had ever told her that in 80 years of life. You don't have to believe your thoughts. And many people chase after the thoughts or live through their thoughts or their images of things. And the world of anxiety, to a great degree, not always, but to a great degree, belongs to that world of thinking. We have a thought that we're worried about something and we get involved in it, we live in it, and we have scenarios and imagination comes into play. And that whole world of imagination means that we're caught and preoccupied. And in that preoccupation kind of covers or inhibits other kinds of sensitivity. It's like, you know, if you are really focused on wanting something out there, an object or a person or something, and you're really fixated, you might not be listening to the sounds in the room because you're focusing on the looking. So if you're focusing on your thoughts, you can get lost. People can get lost in those worlds. I've had from time to time the occasion where it's rather embarrassing to admit this, but I'm hoping everyone had this experience. If I'm alone, then maybe I'm in trouble. But I've had the situation where I've been listening to people, and I didn't hear what they said because I was listening to my own thoughts. So that's not so nice. So, so again, you're preoccupied, caught in our own thinking, and so not even listening to what people are saying. So a lot of the cruelty, a lot of the fear that people have belong to the world of thoughts and ideas and things. But even when there's not fear, I mean, if a person can be caught up in other kind of wholesome thinking, it can be caught up in thoughts of generosity or thoughts of compassion and kindness. But if you're caught up in too much thoughts and thinking about it, that also interferes with the deeper listening of the heart or the deeper sensitivity of the heart. And the primary way of discovering the heart's compassion is being relaxed. And it's a wonderful, I don't know if it's a paradox, a wonderful thing, because for the heart's compassion to be there, we have to be relaxed. And that means when we encounter suffering, the tendency we might have to get anxious or tense around that suffering hinders the continuation of that heartfelt compassion. But it's very easy when your heart feels, you know, feels empathy and feels a kind of pain of the world. It's easy for the old habits of anxiety, the old habits of the fix it and I have to do something and old habits of there's that person out there and there's me here and I have to do something or I have to run away or, you know, it's, you know, all ideas of what it means to be a self and self-image come into play, or the messages we got growing up come into play, how are you supposed to be? And in all those things, it's easy to get back into the world of thinking and the mind and ideas, and then lose the relaxation that gave birth to that heart compassion to begin with. But to stay in touch with the heart compassion requires us to be relaxed, stay relaxed. And what does it take to stay relaxed in being present for someone who might be dying, who clearly the whole family is in kind of distress around what's happening? And what does it take to stay relaxed, soft? And one of the things I think for some people it takes is not believing a lot of the old ideas and messages that we're supposed to be anxious now, or that this is a crisis that requires kind of getting all running around in circles. I love, Julie Wester is a Spirit Rock teacher, colleague, but before she was a teacher, she was a hospice nurse. And I wanted to say something to the family last night that she says to people, but it just didn't seem right at the Christmas party. So I let it go. But at some point she would take the family aside, family of people, someone who was dying, and she'd tell them, from now on, there's no more crisis, no more emergencies. So it means that, you know, if suddenly a person had trouble breathing, or the heart wasn't working properly, or Now, the usual things that you call 911 for, do something serious, now it was no longer going to be treated as a crisis, an emergency. It was just part of the course of nature taking its course, the dying process taking its place. That can be quite hard to hear, quite hard to be willing to do when people are sometimes in the mode that we have to save this person at all costs. Everything, you know, all of medicine goes, you know, towards only saving people, not letting people die in a dignified way or just die as nature takes its course. So then we have these messages, these thoughts and ideas that it's not okay to stay relaxed when we encounter suffering. And this is where practice is so important, to have spent a long time, maybe years, sitting on a cushion meditating, sitting in a chair meditating, maybe being in retreat where you spend days in silence, just being present, learning the muscle of presence, learning to feel palpable, kind of visceral feeling of the stillness or the silence of the body, of the heart, of the mind, that's receptive and open, to learning to be comfortable with extended periods of deep inner silence, deep outer silence, where that deeper sensitivity of the pores of your, the sensitivity, the pores of the heart or the pores of your skin can just be present and open and receptive and feel, and without any, you know, in a sense, any hard barriers or boundaries between self and other. Just be present. Feel comfortable with that. And discover that deep, relaxed place where that inner functioning of the heart can operate is a big part of this heart's compassion. And it doesn't really, and when you encounter someone who's suffering, there's an object, there's a person that you feel compassionate towards. But part of the inner secret of the secret, public secret of practice is that compassion is there without the object. When the heart is deeply relaxed, when we're deeply relaxed and soft, then there's a kind of a sweetness there, a compassion there, that just a sense of being home there. And this heart compassion can be trained, or this heart compassion can be awakened within us. And one of the important qualities for awakening it and discovering it is wanting to. And wanting to become more compassionate. The world needs more compassionate people. It's probably all of us need to, it's good for us, it's good for our own well-being to be compassionate. There's many spiritual teachers say that if you want to be happy, care for other people. As opposed to, you don't hear a lot of spiritual teachers who say, if you want to be happy, get an iPod. Or an iPad, or a MacBook, or all of the above. The more technology you can get, the happier you'll be for sure. That's the secret of technology. I meet people who believe that. My 13-year-old son believes that. So long training and learning to understand ourselves, learning to understand how we get pulled into the world of thoughts, pulled into the world of reactive emotions and ideas, and learning how to relax out of it. And learning, but more than that, but learning to do it enough in meditation, I think, is one of the great places where we begin to relearn, the body begins to relearn something some of us have learned in the past. Many people have learned over a lifetime that to be anxious or to be afraid or to be that desire and wanting and getting or is really the way to go, or to be vain or to be very insecure. We've learned, the mind develops habits. Whatever we do continuously develops habits. And if we're caught up in those kinds of habits, ways of thinking, there's no space or room for the heart sensitivity to be there. And so what we're partly doing in practice is to relearn how to be a different way of being. And one of the one of the important preconditions or conditions for rising of compassion, deep compassion, is feeling safe. And I think the children who don't feel safe growing up have a very difficult time feeling compassion for others or developing it. But children who feel safe, who have a safe environment, feel secure with their family, are the ones who have been measured to be the ones more likely to have compassion when they grow up. For people who are already grown up, you're not going to go back to your parents and ask them to make you safe anymore. But it's really figuring out how to retrain yourself. And I find that meditation is one of the great places to feel a deep sense of inner safety. Some people call it feeling home. To be able to sit still and quiet and begin to relax or let go of all the usual chatter and thoughts and ideas and attitudes that keep us spinning, that keep us not feeling safe, keep us worried and anxious and wanting and doing and all that. And let that all settle down. And it's quite remarkable that when that thinking mind, the anxious mind, the concerned mind relaxes, and we feel relaxed and settled in the body, people feel deeply at home. They feel peaceful. They feel at ease. Sometimes they feel joy in just that kind of way of being. And if you do that long enough, and I think it begins to rewire the circuitry in your mind, begins to kind of change the habits, or the brain. They say the brain has these circuits that get laid down, and then that's the way you develop certain grooves in the circuitry of the brain, and that's where the mind tends to go. The electrons tend to go. And so one of the things we're doing in meditation is to create different grooves. And so I think there's a certain degree of redoing the circuitry in the brain or in the heart, so that different kind of responses tend to happen. And so if we start have an attitude or feeling that we can be safe, then we more likely stay in the relaxed mode, and that relaxed mode is the mode that allows the heart's compassion to operate. It's then the heart's compassion is not something intentional. It might be your intentional mind, which is who decides, it'd be really good to develop compassion, and how do I learn how to be more relaxed? How do I learn to feel safe or to feel at home deeply in myself? And it doesn't come from a lot of fixing it. When fixing it keeps us in that thinking mind. It comes from softening and relaxing and being willing to give up temporarily the fix-it mind, the wanting mind, the fearful mind, the anxious mind. We might have to use the thinking mind, the wisdom mind, to remind ourselves that right at the moment, we're safe. And right at this moment, the IRS is not after you. I hope not, at least. Or right at this moment, there's no one who's trying to steal your wallet. Right at this moment, there are people who are not trying to do something to you. And so that reminder, to be reminded, to remind yourself that here and now it's a safe situation, it can be part of the thinking that helps us to actually then let go and relax. And then compassion can arise. Or we have a better chance for this heartfeltness to be awakened and arise. And then when I think of the heart's compassion, I associate that with a field of compassion. A field to me is like this radiance, or this kind of I don't know what to call it, a field, right? Kind of this thing that radiates outwards in all directions. So it doesn't have a particular focus. And part of the sense of a field is that it doesn't belong. It feels like it doesn't really even belong to me. It doesn't belong to anybody else, I suppose. But I don't feel like I can take credit for compassion when it's coming out of the heart. It doesn't belong to that part of me that I associate with self, because it doesn't belong to that part that has to do with thinking about self or having an identity. It just seems to be kind of just, in a sense, just kind of be there, open and present. And I think this is a very important part of compassion, because then when we feel compassion without a strong sense of self and other, then the compassion can be compassion, suffering with. And you know, the word passion in the old days meant suffering, the passion of Christ. And so to suffer with someone. And I don't know if this is really the etymology of the word sorry, but I read somewhere that sorry comes from the word sore. And so I feel sorry means I feel sore, which maybe you feel, but that's not compassion of the heart. There might be some kind of pain, but there's no soreness. There's a kind of sweetness, though maybe some you don't want to say it. I know sweetness is even the right word, but a sense of rightness, a sense of harmony in a certain kind of way, or a sense of at-homeness with the heart's compassion. The other thing about the heart's compassion is that because it involves being relaxed, I think it's a profound place from which to act, from which our intentions can come forth. Because in Buddhism, compassion is not only feeling empathy for others, but the Buddhist idea of compassion is closely connected to action, to want to do something for someone else, to support them or help them. And I think that the motivation to get off our seat, to get out of out of our own private little inner world and do something for other people works much better when we're relaxed. Because then we don't come along with a lot of self. We're not limited by our fear. We're not limited by our greed. We're not limited by all our concerns that it's impossible, it can't be done. But rather, it just, it kind of flows out of us. So one of the things that surprised me, again, of my early years of practice, was the degree to which, through the practice, there was a seemingly spontaneous movement towards responding to the world around me. I think maybe before that, I'd responded to the world through the vehicle of my desires and wants and ideas and shoulds. And so the world of the mind, in a sense. But as I relaxed and learned to be present in a very simple, simple way, and trusted simple presence, then as I encountered things in the world, it was almost as if the world was requesting of me, respond to this, act on this, do something with it. I remember it was for someone who had never any inclination to clean up after himself when I was younger. It was quite a surprise at some point to discover that when things were messy, there seemed to be kind of just a easy, almost natural kind of thing. Oh, straighten that out. I remember the first time in a Zen center, I was down with Meizumi Roshi in L.A. And we were doing a slow walking they do in the meditation hall. And this person in front of me bent down and straightened out the black mat they were using for sitting on. And I thought, why would a person do that? I thought that was really strange. I mean, I could see that it was crooked, but even so, why would you do anything about it? And I remember how perplexed I was by that. And then some years later, finding myself do the same thing. Almost without thought. It just seemed like the thing to do. So this idea of responding to the world, the response coming from being at home, the response coming from being settled, the response coming from this field of the heart, where it responds in a natural, easy way, as opposed to thinking itself, what do I need to do here? And this is the, go through the list of kind of steps and shoulds and shouldn'ts. It's just what the heart does, it responds. So how far can your compassion go? I think it's really remarkable how far compassion can go. And I'm quite inspired by all the examples we have in the world of so-called ordinary people who find themselves in extraordinary situations. It turns out they had tremendous capacity to respond in ways that even surprised them out of compassion. I hope that each of you to the degree to which you are engaged in this Buddhist practice, will be interested in compassion, be motivated to have the intention to cultivate and develop compassion. But if that's your intention, to then remember that the heart's compassion is not something you approach directly, but it's something you approach by relaxing and relaxing and learning to stay relaxed, and in that relaxed way of being, learning to be present for our world. You might think that it's selfish to focus on your own relaxation, mindfulness-based stress reduction. But I think that as we learn, each of us learn to relax, we become, we relax the self-concern, we relax our selfishness. To be selfish is not to be relaxed, to be preoccupied. And so as we learn to relax in a deep way, then that which is natural inside in the heart has the best chance to come forth and respond to the world. And the world needs lots of compassion. And it needs relaxed people. And the combination of the two, people who are relaxed and compassionate, I think can do the best, offer the best help for the world we live in. So, those are my thoughts for today. And I hope that you have a compassionate 2011.